But these opposing forces do challenge us with our giving, with our missions, with our support of wise and good efforts of government and various agencies to better the lot of people in our own countries and people all around the world. African mission fields challenge us today as never before to demonstrate the humility and helpfulness of Christianity. I envy you your opportunity of hearing Dr. Talbert last night. He's a wonderful Christian, a man whom we are proud and grateful to claim as a Baptist leader. He is vice president of his country. The president, Dr. Tubman, is a Christian also. And today, Liberia stands as a beacon light for Christ on that tortured continent. And I cannot help yearning over the thought of what might have been on that great continent if we had been there with Christianity in force, in time. These are opportunities abroad. And here, in our own countries, we are challenged to demonstrate how peoples of all colors and all nationalities can be treated on a fitting level suited to a Christian estimate of their value as people, as persons. The difficulty of this problem in the situation is such that we say with Paul, I stay here, facing it, working on it, understanding it, until the problem has been solved to the glory of God. To hide behind the beautiful doors of a church, as some of our people do, I regret to say, is to make that church an adversary of the kingdom. And that brings up another matter. Our worldly pride in our churches must be replaced by Christ-like humility if they are to become, as was the church in Ephesus, not a stumbling block in the Lord's cause, but a force promoting it. We cannot take pride in our exquisite equipment if the churches in our mission care are suffering from lack of space and proper tools. Two of the finest young missionaries on our Angola field found the former mission home in a state of absolutely shocking disrepair when they reached a new field. With considerable manual labor on their own part, and the outlay of what seemed a very modest sum of money by this continent's standards, they repaired it. And immediately they found it was a stumbling block. By native standards, it was luxurious, and it roused resentment in the midst of the utter poverty of Angola. Because they were wise as well as dedicated young people, our missionaries used most of those modest rooms for student instruction and Bible training. But we cannot avoid noticing how bewildered young folk from other countries are who come out to study here as new young Christians. They are puzzled by our immense church buildings and our beautiful equipment. In Canada, I know they find the idea of brotherhood and community in Christianity a little difficult to grasp with our million-dollar churches when they can't afford tin shingles or tiles for their roofs in India. These are doors that adversaries open. Forces of government challenge us. Many problems in our own country challenge us. The age in which we live challenges us as churches. And the opposition of the times in which we live challenges us as people to change. Do we live comfortably on this rich continent because we're not sufficiently serious as Christians? Have we forgotten that who gathers not with him scatters? Have we become so part of the world that we see no need for change in ourselves or our surroundings? What is the matter with us? Have we failed to look at ourselves and envision what our lives would be if we went fully Christian? Surely we are challenged to make changes, first in ourselves and then in the world, for the sake of Christ. Yes, these are adversaries that open doors, and doors that adversaries open. And then you come to the unavoidable conclusion, I am the one to work to transform my part of the world, just as Paul was the one at Ephesus. You are the one. How often when we sit and listen and talk in meetings like this, We're moved and convinced, feel that everything that's said has been right. And then we add, but what can I do? What can one person do in so vast a world with so many problems? Remember that Paul's decision was for himself. I stay. Luther was one man when he said, here I stand. You are one, but you're part of a whole. Your Christianity is your faith, your action, your consecration, your knowing Christ. You're seeing the world through Christ's eyes and then doing in your part of it what he would do. What can you do? Well, you're part of a church. You're a member. By the way, do you like your pastor? Many years ago, a young pastor was called to one of the most important Baptist churches in New York City. He hadn't been there very long when some of the leading men began to wonder if he could measure up to the opportunities and demands of the job. What did they do? Did they start to grumble, stay away, talk down to him, try to think of ways of easing him out? They decided to back him to the limit, to promote him in the community. They prayed for and with him. They worked with him. That man became probably the best-known Baptist pastor on this continent, in demand everywhere. And his church became the best-known church in New York City. What can one person do? Those men demonstrated how one member and another can do wonders. And the effect of their work became worldwide because their pastor became in time the president of the Baptist World Alliance. And this brings me down to a thing that's very close to my heart, your part in denominational work. Because you are a part of one of the greatest forces for Christianity in the world. 23 million of us in over 110 countries could save the world. And please God, we can and will transform it. Half of us are women, members of the Women's Department of the Baptist World Alliance. Southern Baptist women have always supported the work of the Women's Department. You've contributed leadership. Right now, your president is the treasurer of the Women's Department. She's your own president, which is a tremendous job. She's president. She's treasurer of the North American Baptist Women's Union, and she's treasurer of our Women's Department. One woman could show no greater interest in her denomination than your president. We're grateful for her. Around the world, women on 6 continents are working to promote fellowship, deeper sympathy, and fuller understanding among our people around the globe. They're exchanging information about activities and ways of work, and they're promoting the Baptist Women's Day of Prayer around the world, of which Miss Hunt spoke just preceding this. Truly, we have joined hearts and hands and voices. And if we're consecrated enough and dedicated enough, we can demonstrate to the world how the Bible, as we understand it, can bring hope and freedom and fellowship to the most widely diversified peoples. And I have an appeal to make to you. The young Baptist minister for whom his deacons prayed in New York was a Canadian. I, too, a Canadian, entering upon the wonderful and great work with which you have all entrusted me, feel inadequate without your support, individually and collectively. Your sympathy, understanding, and prayer. You're a member of the Women's Department. I covet your part in our work. And finally and always, the living God calls us to prayer. That prayer should be soul-searching, for out of prayer comes large learnings. First, about God himself, committing yourself to him sincerely. You will find material everywhere, from the Bible and from your experience, teaching you about God and interpreting Christ to you as you pray. And if you really pray, you will see more clearly every day what is Christ's work in your world, in your home, in your church, in your position, and the significance of what others are and what they are doing will become clearer. And you will see yourself against a new background of understanding of God and Christ and his kingdom, and you will become humble. And if you are sincere, you will go to work at your own special God-given task. It will be much more than others urge upon you, because it will be your own, turning opposition into opportunity, even the opposition within your own soul. And you will find a new joy in Christ, because no longer will you be hiding from him, making it difficult for his will to prevail, but you will be wholly for him, following him into his future. Women of the Southern Woman's Missionary Union, will you work and pray with your sisters around the world, from whom I bring you glad and wholehearted greetings on this eventful day of your convention? Thank you. Thank you.
steeples are falling.
Build on the glory. One of the loveliest hymns, O Zion, Haste, is hymn number 22 in your hymn book. Hymn number 22. And another that you love, I love to tell the story of hymn 15 in your hymn book. Hymn 15. And let us stand as we sing the first and the last verses.
Now is the time for our devotional message for this afternoon, Christian Sharing of Possessions, by Ms. Gordon Ustry.
In these few remaining minutes, we shall briefly think of some of the stewardship teachings of the remaining books of the New Testament. For 2 nights after the crucifixion of their Lord, his disciples, his close followers, remained in hiding, cowed by fear, stunned with inconsolable grief, and perplexed by the meaning of his heavenly precepts and his beautiful ministry. Then, gradually, one by one, they were electrified with the thrilling realization that Christ had risen. The resurrection of Christ, the ascension, Pentecost, brought his followers into absolute surrender. Henceforth, Christ was the sum and substance to them of all things temporal and eternal. They might say, as did Paul later, to live is Christ. A fair and fragrant dawn is the phrase sometimes used to describe those early days of the church. They worshiped together in joy and fellowship. They prayed and they sought to serve the Lord faithfully and beautifully in various types of service. But even so, we must say that ugly clouds were already appearing. First, there was the opposition of the Sadducees. This made the apostles witness even more effectually. Then there was trouble within the church itself. Covetousness showed itself again and caused tragedy, the death of Ananias and Sapphira. Now, many of the church members had sold their property and brought the proceeds thereof and laid it at the apostles' feet. But they were not compelled to sell their property, neither were they required to bring all that they had realized from the sale. The sin of Ananias and Sapphira was a brazen lie at the altar. They stand for all time a warning against hypocrisy and fraud at the altar. As money matters caused the first church discipline, so money matters caused the first church dispute. Some of the Hellenist converts complained that their widows were not receiving their just amount from the common fund, and deacons were appointed to take care of the difficulty. The early leaders of the church recognized the peril in possessions and the danger of covetousness and the need for giving to the Lord, and yet they thought it unnecessary to draft any long set of rules about giving, or as far as that matter goes, about any other phase of Christian living. To them, Christ was the answer to every problem. Ruskin phrases it this way: in the early days of the church, one heard all over the world one momentous question: dost thou believe in Christ?